Matter of State versus Mustafa. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Assistant Deputy Public Defender Kevin Finkenauer on behalf of the defendant, Kader Mustafa.
Good morning, Your Honor. Medic Kamara from Gibbons PC on behalf of Enemies PC as we come from the Queen's Lawyer Team. By the way, the program happened to be ACLU, you can go with
the Good morning, Your Honor. Assistant Prosecutor Melinda Harrigan on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Deputy Attorney General Tom Clark, on behalf of the Chief Attorney General.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Finkenauer, please. We're going to break, by the way, at around 12:30. Let's see how far we can get with the arguments.
Thank you, Your Honors. I was going to waive my opening argument, except to say that, like the first argument, I'm going to start by addressing the broader expert testimony requirement issue, and then move on to discussing why the various errors with respect to this require reversal in Mr. Mustafa's case. Due process requires that the burden always remain on the state to prove every essential element of an offense beyond a reasonable doubt. The concept of diminished capacity flows from this bedrock principle and allows defendants to adduce evidence of a mental disease or defect whenever it's relevant to disproving the mens rea. In a sense, this statute is a little redundant because a defendant can never be precluded from adducing evidence that is relevant to holding the state to its burden. Because a defendant cannot bear any burden with respect to an argument that the state has failed to prove an essential element, the Third Circuit in Humanick versus Breyer held that defendants cannot be required to prove diminished capacity by a preponderance of the evidence. That holding was incorporated by our own courts, and it was reflected in the statutes by amendments to the diminished capacity statute. When that decision came out, the legislature was debating what to do moving forward. And they made a very conscious choice to have a statute of broad admission. They had originally conceived of repealing that statute entirely and adding a section to 2C2-2, which is the general culpability statute, having a very strict allowance of certain kinds of diminished capacity evidence. And they elected not to do that. They elected to preserve this evidence and in their, or preserve this statute allowing this evidence. And in their own words, now it simply allows the introduction of evidence of mental health issues that are relevant to the mens rea that the state is obliged to prove.
Sorry, can you provide the citation for that?
For the legislative history?
I think so, yes.
It's in my appendix. DSA 10 is what I'm talking about. And certain of the pages prior have the earlier versions that were considered and then not accepted. These basic principles, this due process principle, precludes a requirement that defendants must produce expert testimony before a jury can be instructed on diminished capacity. There's no dispute that lay testimony has always been admissible in support of a diminished capacity argument. And it's often been considered very significant evidence in favor of requiring that instruction. There is also no dispute that the law as it is does not require a diagnosis in order to present a diminished capacity defense. Our case law has expressly held this, and the model charge does not require a diagnosis in order to submit it to the jury. Given this, there's no reason that lay testimony by itself cannot be enough to meet the low rational basis threshold necessary for instructing on diminished capacity. Of course, there has to be some evidence in the record of diminished capacity before a defendant can get the charge that may appear in the state's case, like Mr. Mustafa's, where they have their own interest in adducing that kind of evidence, and defense counsel crosses to adduce additional evidence. If there's no evidence in the state's case and the defendant wanted that charge, of course, they would have to produce some proofs of their own. But there is no burden on them to prove diminished capacity, and certainly no requirement that they need to present an expert to get that instruction.
Sorry, under 2C4-2, it says evidence that the defendant suffered from a mental disease or defect is admissible, dot, dot, dot.
Right.
Are you saying that there is no, everyone agrees that evidence of mental disease or defect does not have to be any diagnosis? I thought it was just that everyone agreed that you don't need a specific diagnosis, but I thought the whole case that we're here about is that the state is arguing that you do need some diagnosis from some expert about a mental disease or defect.
Well, that's what the state's arguing, but my argument is that the case law is relatively clear that that's not required. The appellate division State versus Cotter said, quote, doctors need not conclude that defendant suffers from a particular condition or disorder, and no DSM manual diagnosis is necessary to support the defense. And they take that from this court's decision in Galloway, where it said that, you know, however a psychiatrist or the DSM might label a particular mental health issue isn't dispositive for whether it could be presented to the jury as a diminished capacity argument.
Can you define the terms mental disease and mental defect for us?
I will at least say that mental defect, part of the Galloway case, the whole point of the Galloway case was that defect specifically was intended to be construed broadly to encompass really any manner of cognitive impairment that might be going on with someone that is relevant to the mens rea that the state is obligated to prove. So it could be a limited learning disability, it could be Asperger's, it could be blackout spells, it could be any number of things that go to some cognitive impairment that would be relevant to the state of mind that the state is obligated to prove.
And are you applying that definition to both sets of terms or just mental defect?
Well, it certainly applies to defect. I think really it's both.
How do you define mental disease?
I don't know that I can offer a specific definition of mental disease other than something going on with someone that is relevant to the state of mind.
So how then would an ordinary layperson understand the meaning of the terms and how they should be applied?
Well, I think that in general, the idea of a mental health impairment of some kind is within lay people's understanding, that people are aware of mental disabilities and incapacities and impairments of various kinds. And that is often understood through the way that someone behaves and speaks and acts and interacts with others.
But you just said you couldn't define it for the Chief Justice's question. So you're saying you can't define it, but an ordinary layperson on the jury would be able to?
Well, I mean, again, it's that something is going on cognitively in someone's mind that is abnormal, I think is something that most people can understand. And I think that those labels are generally what that refers to.
Is it disease or defect? Something that's going on cognitively in someone's mind that may be abnormal?
Certainly defect, but I think a little bit of both. And part of the idea of the Galloway case is that these labels are a little squishy because psychiatry is very inexact.
And isn't that exactly why the Galloway case said that after the court has determined that the evidence of the condition of the question is relevant and sufficiently accepted within the psychiatric community?
Right. So Galloway did say that, and I can address that that dicta in that case now about why I think that's not dispositive. Part of the issue, well, for one, they don't make any citations for why these are the requirements of the diminished capacity statute after it had been amended. It wasn't the main issue in that case. The main issue was not what specifically a defendant had to prove. It was just what labels kind of fit within the ambit of disease or defect for diminished capacity, and the holding was that it should be done broadly. But part of the issue is that those requirements seem to be the same requirements that existed before the statute was amended. So it can't be that the defendant had the exact same evidentiary burden under the older, stricter standard where they had to prove it as an affirmative defense, and now they have absolutely no burden, but are still somehow subject to the exact same evidentiary burden. I don't think that makes any sense. Again, the thrust of the case broadly was that we should consider any kind of mental impairment that would go to the state of mind that the state is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And an expert might be helpful in these cases. I don't think there's any dispute that sometimes it might be preferable, but it's just not a requirement as a matter of law to meet the low threshold that's necessary for instructing a jury on diminished capacity.
Can you explain to us why you think that your argument is different from the argument in the case we just heard?
Well,
or do you think it's the same? Do they stand and fall if we were to decide that expert testimony is required in order for an insanity jury instruction to be presented to the jury, would you have to lose? How do you see the cases as the same or different?
No, I would say that if this court decides that there is no extra requirement for insanity, that there certainly cannot be one for diminished capacity because it's a broader statute for which the defendant bears no burden. So it can't be that there is one for insanity or there's not one for insanity and that there is for diminished capacity. But it's exactly for those reasons that even if there is one for insanity, that doesn't necessitate that there is one for diminished capacity, which is a distinct statute, a distinct legal idea. And although there are substantive similarities between these two concepts, legally and functionally, they are fairly distinct.
Sorry, so can you talk a little bit more about those distinctions? That's what I was asking.
Sure. So insanity is an affirmative defense that the defendant bears the burden of proving to the jury. Whereas diminished capacity, it's not strictly a defense, really just refers to a type of evidence that is considered in the context of the state's entire case and goes to whether or not the state has proven the mens rea, the necessary mental state, beyond a reasonable doubt. So one of the cases that comes to mind is State versus Sexton, where the appellate division held that a defendant should have been allowed to admit testimony from his mother and grandmother that he suffered from learning disabilities and was in special education classes and things like that in order to show that he might have not believed that the gun was loaded that he fired at another person with. And so that's something that might not reach the level of insanity. But it's a mental impairment that goes to the necessary mental state that the state is required to prove. And just to talk a little bit about the test, it's never been explicitly stated that the rational basis test is the evaluating standard for assessing when a defendant should get a diminished capacity instruction. But certainly the language is very similar. The case law has said that the evidence should be evaluated, giving the defendant all reasonable inferences. And only if there's no suggestion of diminished capacity, then a jury should not be instructed on it. That's functionally very similar, almost identical to the rational basis standard that we use for other similar defenses, like self-defense and voluntary intoxication, and for lesser included offenses, which is also something that's related to diminished capacity in a way that insanity is not. I think that is all I had on that issue, unless your honors had any other questions on the broader expert testimony requirement.
Please go ahead.
So moving on, if there is no expert testimony requirement for diminished capacity, then Mr. Mustafa certainly should have been given that instruction here. There was more than enough evidence in the state's case to meet that threshold, evidence that he had gang stalking delusions, that he had been hospitalized, that he wore a tinfoil hat, that he put tinfoil on his car antenna, that he lost an extreme amount of weight, that he would instruct his girlfriend to disassemble her phone so they would not be followed. Very, very detailed testimony about these paranoid delusions.
About erratic behavior. You're not talking there necessarily about a mental defect or a mental disease. I mean, it seems to me that the only testimony about a mental defect or a mental disease comes from his girlfriend, who says his behavior sort of resembled my uncle, who was a paranoid schizophrenic. That seems to be the only testimony that is tying his behavior to a mental defect or a mental disease.
So your honor is talking about a diagnosis, but we already know that we don't need a diagnosis.
About the statute.
Right, so certainly this is evidence of a mental disease or defect, because lay testimony of this type has always been admissible in support of that defense. If Mr. Mustafa was to go to a psychiatrist and be evaluated, these are exactly the proofs that the person is going to assess and consider in making a kind of diagnosis, because those are proofs from which one could conclude that
we don't
a person
know what
had
that diagnosis would be.
Right, but again, there is no specific diagnosis that's needed. All that's needed is a rational basis from which a person can conclude that the person was suffering from a mental disease or defect.
At the time of the offense.
At the time of the offense, that's correct.
And then all we have about a mental defect is the girlfriend's testimony. The other is just erratic behavior.
Well,
I don't know how you tie tinfoil to a mental defect, necessarily.
Again, it's if Mr. Mustafa was going to a psychiatrist to be evaluated, he would want to know that Mr. Mustafa was wearing a tinfoil hat at all times, because that's the kind of evidence that supports a conclusion that someone might have a kind of mental disorder. Even the psychiatrist is not going to be able, it's not an exact science. The psychiatrist is going to be doing much like the jurors are doing, which is hearing all this evidence and making an after the fact assessment of what he thinks might be going on with the person. But certainly it is evidence of a potential disease or defect. And I think it's something that's within lay people's capabilities to understand. If there is no expert testimony requirement, these are the exact kind of proofs that are going to be used for diminished capacity. They would look exactly like this.
What about the tinfoil around the antenna? That was offered as evidence of, I guess what you're saying is a mental defect, that he put tinfoil around his antenna. Is that also, you think, something that the jury should consider and say, well, yeah, that's probably a mental defect because he has tinfoil around his antenna?
Right. I think that is part of the tableau from which a reasonable juror can conclude that he was suffering from some kind of mental disease or disorder. That by itself probably would not be enough. But in the context of, again, detailed testimony about how he believed people were following him, how he shot down drones he thought were following him.
How he believed that he was being shot with radiation.
Correct. That he was hospitalized because he thought his kidneys were failing because people were beaming radiation beams into him. In the context of all these things, a reasonable person could certainly conclude that person might be suffering from a mental disease or defect. And the jurors don't have to conclude by some quantum of evidence that he was. For diminished capacity, it's simply admitting evidence that is part of the tapestry that we put in front of jurors to assess whether or not the state has reached its burden. So the ultimate question is only whether or not the state has proven the essential mens rea, and that's a pure jury question. That's not an expert's question.
I'll ask a similar question that I asked in the first argument. How is a jury equipped to differentiate between someone who is actually suffering from a mental disease or defect and someone who's malingering?
To echo counsel's argument, they're tasked with assessing difficult questions all the time. And I mean, there's no way with any degree of exactitude to determine whether someone is or is not malingering. They look at the proofs and they make a decision. And the prosecutor may be able to go up and say, you know, that these aren't enough, that they don't establish a disease or defect, that they don't cast enough doubt on the mens rea. And those kinds of arguments can be presented. But it's enough of that minimal threshold to allow the issue to be submitted to a jury and for them to make the assessment.
But isn't that a bit dismissive of the concept of malingering? I mean, an analysis or a determination that someone has malingered, that's a very in-depth analysis. It usually requires the application of two or three different tests. I can't remember their names right now, but I used to know them 10 years ago. And then it's a sort of an accumulation of those tests and how they work together. And you're saying that the jury should be able to pick up on, to Justice Pierre-Louis' question, that the jury, as lay people, should be able to pick up on what is and has for years been known to require a very exacting analysis and a very comprehensive analysis.
All that diminished capacity statute allows for is for the jurors to consider this type of evidence in the context of the state's burden of proving the mens rea. So again, they don't have to find a specific illness. They don't have to specifically find that an illness has been established. They only have to be told that they are able to consider this evidence in the context of the state's case.
Go ahead. Where from the statute, I see in the statute that it says evidence that the defendant suffered from a mental disease or defect is admissible whenever it is relevant to prove that the defendant did not have a state of mind, which is an element of the offense. Where do you see the requirement about what you need in order to get a jury instruction? Here, the evidence was already in, correct? In that Ms. Fiore testified that he was wearing tinfoil, thought he was being shot with radiation, et cetera, et cetera. This speaks to when evidence can be admitted. Here it was already admitted. So where do we get from here? And you need this specific threshold in order to get a jury instruction.
So the test that was enunciated in Galloway that I would submit is similar to the rational basis test that we use to evaluate like defenses, is that if you look at all the proofs and you look at it in the light most favorable to what the defense is arguing, only if there is no suggestion of disease or defect, then the court should deny the diminished capacity instruction. So that's the kind of evaluating test that this court has enunciated for assessing that issue that I think is correct, despite my other issues with certain of the language in Galloway.
So then is this case not really about the statute? Because the statute doesn't say anything about what is required to get a jury instruction and is instead about Galloway?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that the statute was intended to encompass such a broad range of evidence and mental health issues, and I think because the legislature could have readily included an expert testimony requirement, if that's what is needed, like the state is asserting is needed, that's something that's important for this issue. And I think it's especially significant because they specifically reevaluated the statute after Humanik and said, what is intended by the statute and what do we need? And they went broader and they did not include anything that would restrict it. And they certainly did not include a requirement that there has to be an expert.
But Galloway's crystal clear in its language that there needs to be an expert.
So again, I think that case had not yet quite moved on from the status of diminished capacity as an affirmative defense. It was very shortly after the statute was amended. It didn't grapple with the issues that we're talking about now. I don't think it really sat with the consequences of enunciating that kind of test. And then most significantly, that's the exact same proofs that defendants were supposed to be putting forward before the statute was amended.
13 years later, Baum relies upon the exact same statement.
So I would say that that's more just regurgitating boilerplate than really.
These are Supreme Court precedents. So we have right. Two Supreme Court precedents that make crystal clear. You have to have an expert testify to satisfy the diminished capacity, to allow you to proffer diminished capacity.
It wasn't an issue that was presented in Baum at all. It didn't go into at all the kinds of things that we're talking about. I was explaining what our courts have held with respect to diminished capacity, which is what decisions do, but I don't think it was a reasoned conclusion that expert testimony was required, like this court will do in this case.
Those two Supreme Court precedents aren't a reasoned conclusion?
No, I didn't mean to say that, Your Honor. It wasn't considering this issue in this amount of depth in this context.
Saying it was dicta?
That's correct, Your
Honor. Okay.
Can I just go back to Justice Pierre-Louis's question? So on cross-examination, on the issue of malingering, could on cross-examination the prosecutor basically ask sort of one of the 50-question malingering tests to determine whether whoever is testifying is malingering or not? Would that be appropriate cross-examination?
I don't know that it would be appropriate for a prosecutor to sit with a checklist of some a DSM assessment or something and go through asserting or trying to determine whether or not someone is malingering.
How else do they test whether that person was malingering or
they,
not?
They ask probing questions about the person's life and their behaviors, the same way that you do for producing evidence in favor of the mental.
But that doesn't illness. Answer the question as to whether their testimony is malingering or not.
It might not be answered with absolute definitiveness. It is something that both sides will adduce their proofs on, and then it will go to the jury.
Is a defendant required to submit to an evaluation so that a state expert can evaluate whether that defendant is malingering?
Yes, I think that if, even if a defense does not put on an expert, if the state wants to evaluate him to rebut a diminished capacity issue, that would be fine.
But isn't it the case then that the state has the right to put on an expert witness and ask the questions that Justice Hoffman was just asking to sort of lay the groundwork for when the expert comes in to testify?
Well, I think certain probing questions, I would say it strikes me as inappropriate to interrogate a witness in the exact same way as a psychiatric assessment specifically.
It sounds to me like you're saying it strikes me as inappropriate to actually find out in a more definitive way whether the witness was malingering.
Well, I would say if they really wanted to do that, then they could hire their own expert and they could get that assessment themselves.
And you're saying, sorry, that the defendant could be compelled if they want to raise diminished capacity or argue that they're entitled to a diminished capacity instruction, then they can be compelled to sit for a psychiatric examination with the state's expert, even if they themselves do not hire an expert.
I don't see any reason that would be... It's not striking me as improper. And before I moved on to why the conviction should be reversed, even if there is an expert testimony requirement, I just wanted to bring this court's attention to its previous case in State versus Oglesby, which is 122 NJ 522, where this court found not only that there was a rational basis for diminished capacity, but that it was clearly indicated by proofs that are very similar to what you have here, by testimony about how the defendant thought he was talking to Jesus and Mary, that he believed that his car was inhabited by a demon, and that he believed he had visited with this demon before and he was seeing things that weren't there. There
Can you
was
give the citation one more time? I'm sorry.
Sure. It's 122 NJ 522.
And it'll always be there was expert testimony.
There was expert testimony, Your Honor, but really it hardly factored at all into this court's conclusion that diminished capacity was clearly indicated. The primary focus by far was on exactly this kind of testimony, which is very similar testimony to what you have here. And you can see this in other cases as well. State versus Juinta, which is an appellate division case, and State versus Moore, the 1988 State versus Moore, where among many other things, the defendant's aunt had written a letter opining that her niece was exhibiting characteristics of split personality disorder. And this court said, although not a trained psychiatrist, they considered it notable that this person who knew the defendant well was exhibiting these changes and these behaviors and had these opinions of
it. In those two cases, there was also expert testimony, right?
There was, Your Honor. I get it. It is, my point is only that lay testimony is admissible and it is often given great weight, and it is not indicative from these cases that an expert was required and that those things on their own would not have been enough for this kind of instruction.
It wasn't a requirement, but in Oglesby, there was that baseline that an expert had said that the defendant was a paranoid schizophrenic, and that created that baseline where the lay witnesses could then add to it with their opinions of what they saw. Isn't that the difference, that we don't have that here?
It's a distinguishing factor, but again, reading the case and reading this court's decision on that issue specifically in that case, it doesn't strike me as a dispositive factor, as something that would have caused the court to come out differently, even if a psychiatrist had not testified. And I would just say again that that was under clearly indicated, which is a much higher threshold than rational basis, which is what you have here when the defendant actually makes the request. And then lastly, even if there is an expert testimony requirement, even if this court holds, for whatever reason, that diminished capacity should not have been instructed, his convictions would otherwise have to be reversed because his defense attorney believed throughout the entire proceedings that he would be able to have this instruction presented to the jury. He induced significant proofs about Mr. Mustafa's delusions that if he was not able to make this defense, he certainly would not have elicited, because they are highly, highly prejudicial in the absence of an instruction telling the jury that they consider this, that they can consider that in respect to a diminished capacity defense.
Counsel, without telling us anything that you shouldn't or that you can't, why was there no medical records presented, no expert testimony? Was it the defendant's wish or something else that you're at liberty to tell us?
I honestly have no idea. Defense counsel was deceased by the time I handled this case. So I just don't know. I only know what's in the record. They made a choice that they
didn't.
Thanks.
Aren't you also ignoring the testimony of the jail call with the girlfriend, in which he admits that I was trying to scare those people and that he didn't intend for the bullet to anything? He thought it was an accident. I mean, isn't that also, you know, relevant to the idea that at the time he wasn't suffering from sort of a mental defect that precluded him from creating mens rea when he admits in a jail call that he intentionally shot for the purpose of trying to scare people and didn't intend to hit anybody, and that it was an accident that he did hit somebody?
Sure, it is relevant, and that is an argument that the state can make alongside the defense making their own arguments, which they were completely barred from doing at all, about this type of evidence.
I also don't think it's relevant as to whether the defense should go in or not.
I don't think it moves the needle with respect to whether or not diminished capacity should have been instructed, no.
We haven't touched on the constitutional argument as we're approaching 30 minutes. You're advancing a constitutional argument as amici are, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Well, part of it is the...
Is it foreclosed by Clark?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Clark versus Arizona?
Yes.
So part of the thing with that case...
Not Mr. Clark.
Clark versus right. Arizona. So that case, my recollection is that the holding was that a statute that says that the kind of expert testimony that the state is saying is necessary is not admissible. But it still said that you are able to adduce these kinds of proofs with respect to whether or not the state has met its mens rea burden about the defendant's mental state, because those can never be excluded. So these kinds of proofs are always, always admissible. This is just something that we use to help clarify things for the jury with respect to these issues. And I think an expert testimony requirement substantially infringes on that due process interest. It very expressly burden shifts with respect to an issue for which the defense bears no burden. And then moving on to a kind of more amorphous right to present a complete defense.
Maybe I've misunderstood Clark. Did it hold that there's no due process violation with respect to restricting and eliminating the significance directly on the issue of the mental element of mens rea when it comes to defense evidence?
I might have to take another look at it, Your Honor. But my recollection was that the statute at issue is something that wouldn't necessarily be implicated by the arguments that we're making here. The court...
How many states don't allow the defense altogether?
I think 13.
Are they all in violation of the Constitution?
I would suggest yes. And there's an academic article that also suggests yes. But also, I think...
I thought this... Go ahead, Chief.
Oh, go ahead.
I thought Clark held that you do not, it is okay for the state to not allow a diminished capacity instruction.
So
against a constitutional federal due process challenge.
Again, I think what they were talking about was experts coming in and expressly saying the defendant could not have formed the necessary mental state because of a disease or defect, which is something that the state is saying is needed. My position is not that testimony needs to be in these cases, but you can't ever, again, going back to the defendant in State versus Sexton, who had significant learning disabilities and wanted to adduce that in support of an argument that he did not know that the gun was loaded when he shot it. That can never be excluded, I believe, under Clark as well.
Let me read for you the opening paragraph, parts from the opening paragraph of Clark. The question was whether Arizona violated due process in restricting consideration of defense evidence of mental illness and incapacity to its bearing on insanity, thus eliminating its significance directly on the issue of the mental element of the crime charge, mens rea.
I can only say that my recollection is that they still admitted that some type of that has to be allowed.
The court goes on to say, we hold there's no violation of due process in either instance.
Right. I would have to take another look at the case, Your Honor. But I would submit in any event that we should hold otherwise. If that's the holding, then I think that is fundamentally wrong. Again, going back to the example in Sexton, why should that person be precluded from adducing evidence of their limited cognitive capacity?
So you're asking the court to rule on the basis of the New Jersey Constitution?
In addition to federal, I would submit, yes.
We obviously, though, can't decide a question of federal law different from the U.S. Supreme Court, correct? So if they say something is constitutional under the federal constitution, we can't say, no, it's not.
Well, I would also say that once you create a protectable interest that might not exist in other states, that might invoke constitutional protections, even though the Constitution itself does not create on its own an interest of that kind.
We'll hear what your friends have to say about Clark.
All right, thank you, Ron.
Thank you. Ms. Morelli.
Good morning, and may it please the court. As my colleague, Mr. Finkenauer, opened with, this case really is about the fundamental due process right of criminal defendants to raise a reasonable doubt as to whether they had the requisite mental state for the offense with which they are charged. But I would actually like to start by picking up on my colleague's discussion or my colleague's argument, really, that diminished capacity is not inherently beyond the ken of the average juror, such that expert testimony is necessary in all cases where diminished capacity is advanced as a defense. So first, I'd like to place the idea of a categorical expert testimony in context a little. A categorical expert testimony requirement in context a little. As we explain in our brief, the circumstances under which a court will mandate expert testimony are rare and limited. Most commonly, this really occurs in the civil context when a standard of care in a specialized field must be described so that a juror can assess whether or not that standard has been met, such as in dental or medical malpractice cases, and also when causation between the deviation from the standard of care and injury must be established, again, in the context of such specialized industries. We argue that the specialized nature of those circumstances do not translate over to every single circumstance in which a diminished capacity argument is advanced. And here, I would like to use an analogy that might illustrate this point. Imagine that you observe someone you know suddenly walking with a pronounced limp today that they did not have yesterday. In that moment, you won't know what specifically is causing the limp. You won't know if it's an injury to their leg, to their back. You won't know if it's something neurological. If it is an injury, you won't know what type of injury it is. But you will certainly be able to recognize the fact that they're limping and to know that that fact of them limping raises, in this analogous context, a reasonable doubt as to whether they can go on with their day the way they might have yesterday without this.
Is that truly analogous? I think neurologists and psychiatrists and psychologists have made compelling cases for the complexity of mental illness, that with all due respect to broken ankles and sprained ankles is perhaps in a different category.
So, Your Honor, we agree as an initial matter that the fields of psychiatry and the fields of medicine, as I was referencing in this analogy, are complex fields. But what a jury is being asked to do in a case in which a defendant is advancing a diminished capacity argument is to consider whether evidence of mental disease or defect raises a doubt as to the mental element of an offense which the state has the burden of proving. And this evidence of mental disease or defect, as my colleague Mr. Frankenauer discussed in our law, does not require a diagnosis and often presents as facts that are clearly recognizable to the average juror as evidence of such mental disease or defect that would raise a reasonable doubt. And no facts really illustrate this more compellingly than Mr. Mustafa's case. Mr. Finkenauer discussed the facts. It bears repeating. He was found wearing a tinfoil blanket. He was found wearing several hats with tinfoil in between them. He believed for years that he was being gang stalked and attacked by radioactive beams from cars. These facts are recognizable to the ordinary, to the average juror, as evidence of mental disease or defect that would raise a reasonable doubt as to the mental element of the offense for which he is being charged. And I'd just like to take a moment to briefly address, as Mr. Finkenauer did, the language in Galloway saying that there is a requirement that evidence of diminished capacity be sufficiently accepted for use within the psychiatric community. And I apologize to use yet another analogy here, but in kind of thinking about this language, I was thinking about how a cough, the symptom or a fact of a cough, is surely accepted for use within the medical community as evidence of some disease or illness.
Or allergies.
Yes, precisely.
We're trying to get out of going to school.
Yes, precisely. Sure. Yes, I will address that point, Justice Hoffman, in a second. But so the average juror doesn't...
Some members of the court are a little wondering if that's the best analogy, a cough.
Sure, sure.
Having coughed during this argument because of allergies.
Sure. I think the point is, though, the average juror doesn't need expert testimony to confirm that a cough is a symptom that is accepted for use within the medical community to make a specific diagnosis of an illness, which is not required for a defendant advancing a diminished
capacity. How does that help you with this argument? If a cough is considered a symptom that someone with medical expertise can then apply their expertise and distill down to perhaps a diagnosis of a disease, whatever it may be, why does that help your point that no such professional is needed in order to do that?
Because, Your Honor, the same is true for facts that go to the presence of a mental disease or defect. A psychiatrist who is evaluating someone presenting with mental health symptoms is going to use precisely the facts that Mr. Mustafa presents within this case. He was wearing a tinfoil blanket. He was he harbored delusions for years that he was being gang stalked.
A psychiatrist has had years and years of education in order to interpret behavioral signs and symptoms in a professional manner that has meaning with respect to whether there's a disease or a defect, a mental disease or defect. So to say that, well, jurors in ordinary life can evaluate that someone may have a particular symptom and that may or may not lead to a diagnosis, how can they do that? Can they distill that information unguided by someone with the professional credentials to do that?
Well, the average juror in a diminished capacity case, Your Honor, is only being asked to basically do the first part of that, to identify the symptom and then to consider whether that symptom raises a reasonable doubt as to the mental element of the offense. They are not being asked to do the second part of what a psychiatrist would do. And I think the point is that the language in Galloway, sufficiently accepted for use within the psychiatric community, really goes to the nature of the evidence. The nature of the evidence, such as a symptom that could be used by a psychiatrist to make their, you know, diagnosis, which a jury is not being asked to do.
Wasn't Galloway really reflecting Frye?
Yes. And I believe my colleague in his briefs has discussed how New Jersey has abandoned the Frye standard. And here I'm really making the point that even if you, you know, read this language in Galloway as there's a way to read this language in Galloway as not being in tension with our position here, because it's really talking about the nature of the evidence, which must be that of mental disease or defect as the statute itself prescribes, rather than mandating a specific type of evidence, which would be expert testimony requirement, which we submit is not required inherently in all cases where a defendant is advancing a diminished capacity argument.
But it's not just identifying erratic behavior, it's saying a mental defect or disease had the capacity to override knowing and intentional behavior. And you're saying that a juror, without any assistance in that regard, any assistance from the psychiatric community, as Galloway calls it, can be able to make that leap based purely upon lay testimony of, for instance, his behavior sort of resembled my uncle's schizophrenia.
Yes, Your Honor, that is what we're saying, because this is what jurors are tasked with doing in all criminal cases. In all criminal cases, jurors are being asked to get inside the mind of a defendant and to assess, based on the evidence presented at trial, based on what they find most credible or compelling, why the defendant did what he did. A juror might well decide, you know, this evidence that I heard of mental disease or defect is not compelling to me, and so I don't think that they acted this way because...
But this is a different question. The question is, did a mental defect or disease have the capacity to override mens rea? That's a very different question.
Well, I think the legal question, Your Honor, really is, did the mental disease or defect mean that this, does that raise a reasonable doubt as to whether the defendant has the requisite mens rea for the offense with which they're being charged? Raising a reasonable doubt is a question that is always left to the jurors to determine based on the evidence presented to them at trial. And, you know, there's really nothing about this specific question. Why did the defendant act in the way that they did? Did this evidence of mental disease or defect that I heard at trial come into play at all? This really isn't significantly different from the questions jurors are asking themselves in the context of any other criminal cases when they're weighing evidence presented at trial that may go to any number of factors or influences that were at play when a defendant committed.
This has happened. Particular question, is it your position that the jury needed to decide whether or not this was akin to someone being schizophrenic, or just that the jury needed to decide, look, there are all of these instances of very odd behavior, and that perhaps indicates that this person could not have acted with the knowledge and intent that was required?
Exactly, Your Honor. That's our position. And that really goes to the idea, once again, that there is no requirement of a diagnosis in order for a defendant to be successful as to a diminished capacity defense.
So, and even if, Ms. Fiore had not said this resembled my uncle who had schizophrenia, which perhaps she should not have been able to say because she is not a professional who diagnoses schizophrenia, your argument would be exactly the same. It's just about the behaviors that she witnessed, not about her characterizing them as similar to her uncle who was schizophrenic.
Right. It's really about the totality of the facts in the case. And Ms. Fiore's testimony is one particular part of it, but it is not a necessary portion of it, nor does her reference to a specific diagnosis. That's not dispositive for the purposes of Mr. Mustafa's argument here.
Yeah. Bring your argument to a close after this next question.
And none of this evidence would be precluded to argue that mens rea was not met. The question is just, would it be able to be attached to a diminished capacity charge, right? So all the evidence would still go into mens rea, and whether mens rea was met, only question is whether you can attach it to a diminished capacity charge, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And we believe that while Your Honor is right that the murder charge itself instructs the jury to consider all evidence going to the mens rea, the value of the diminished capacity instruction is to give the jury the tools they need to understand how to situate the evidence they've heard at trial. Mens rea determinations, the question of diminished capacity as a defense, are legal questions, and it's important for jurors in our system of justice to receive the tools they need in order to know how to properly consider and weigh the relevant evidence they've heard at trial in with respect to the questions that they're answering. And I'll quickly wrap up my argument now and just really end with the point, which has been kind of underlying my argument thus far, that a categorical expert testimony requirement, in addition to running afoul of the Constitution, as my colleagues will discuss, really risks undermining the role of the jury as the preeminent fact finder in our system of justice. This court has specifically held that expert testimony that relates to straightforward facts encroaches on the jury's responsibility to decide disputed facts and determine whether the state has proven the charges against a defendant. With everything that we've discussed, it's our position that diminished capacity is not always inherently beyond the ken of the average juror, and courts should, and this court should not subvert the role of the jury in that manner by imposing a categorical expert testimony requirement. And lastly, it is also important for defense counsel to have the ability to make strategic decisions as to how best to effectively represent their clients, including by making the choice as to whether to present an expert at trial or not.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll be back in about 30 minutes.